Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the committee, the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. And we have in our packets, we have a quorum. And in our packets, we have the minutes of Valentine's Day, February 14th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Madam Chair, so moved.
All right. Thank you. Representative Cantrell moves the minutes of February 14th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Thank you. So we are going to hear a couple of bills today. The first one is going to be House File 679, Representative Morrison. But before we do that, Mr. Burdick is here from the Department of Human Services to give us a very brief overview of the topic that the bill addresses. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Burdick. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Burdick, I am the Legislative Director for Healthcare, Behavioral Health, and Housing at the Department of Human Services. And as the Chair mentioned, I'm just going to give a brief overview of children's residential treatment services, how they are funded, and what recent interpretations from the federal government have meant for that funding structure to give a little bit of a background, especially for the folks that have not dealt with this topic in the past. So just to begin, wanting to orient to an acronym you're going to be hearing a lot about in the context of this, IMD. That stands for Institution for Mental Disease. That phrase comes out of the federal law governing Medicaid. And essentially what that says is that if you have a program that is a residential program that has greater than 16 beds that primarily serves to treat people with either mental health or substance use disorders, that is no longer that a person when they are there is no longer eligible for federal Medicaid matching dollars. That the federal government is not going to allow that federal-state partnership to occur for services a person receives while they are residing in one of these facilities. There is one exception that was recently codified, that if a person is in a facility for less than 15 days in a month and they are in managed care, states can still collect federal matching funds in those instances. But for the most part, the general rule is 16 beds or more, and there's no federal matching funds available. And that's not just for the services provided by those facilities. That's for all services a person's receiving while they are in that facility. However, in Minnesota, we have a state law, sometimes known as Program IM, that allows us to essentially replace the lost federal dollars in these circumstances with state dollars. So when a person's in fee-for-service, the state is paying the full share and picking up the lost federal share, and the same is true in managed care. We would be state funding the full capitation payment to the managed care programs for any month that a person's there for longer than 15 days. So children's residential facilities are facilities that we've had in Minnesota since 2001, and they're funded a little bit differently, which is an important context for this conversation. In the fee-for-service environment, counties are actually responsible for the non-federal share. So the portion that the state would typically pay is actually paid by the counties and then matched with federal dollars. For managed care, it operates in the same way it does for other services, just because it's too hard to disentangle that when we're paying a capitation payment for that full set of services. In 2014, CMS sent the state a letter indicating that they had some concerns that some of our programs may in fact be considered IMDs. And as you can see, there was quite a few years of back and forth between the state and the federal government. Our congressional delegation weighed in, trying to assert that the agreement that we had struck with the federal government way back in 2001 should stand. Unfortunately, we eventually did not succeed in that conversation, and so we're forced to complete a review of programs in Minnesota and submit a report to CMS. Currently, we have 8 programs in Minnesota that are IMDs with a total of 363 beds. I should add, the number of beds that you'll see in this conversation sometimes fluctuates. That really depends on how you look at things. We do also pay for children when they are placed in border states, and so we've got about 50 kids last year that were served in border states that were considered IMDs and so are subject to these same payment limitations. And When we initially did the review, we had a couple of programs that did some changes to their programmatic model. Then we re-reviewed them and found them to no longer be IMDs. So that's where you'll sometimes see this number fluctuate. But this number right here is pretty static as we sit today. So historically, Children's Residential Treatment Services were not part of that state law I referred to earlier, the Program IM law that allows us to capture state funding for services. Now, the interesting and I think frustrating piece of this is it's actually just the services those facilities provide. So, for instance, if a child went to the dentist, they would still be able to get the state funding for that dental service. It's just the services actually directly provided by those facilities that was not included in the state law to give us the state funding. So in 2017, the legislature amended that law to authorize state funding for these services. And in the way that that shook out in the final budget that year, that law is set to expire on May 1st, 2019, so May 1st of this year. And so if that authority expires, when a child is in one of these programs, the county would be 100% responsible for the cost of care for the services that program provides. And this last slide here is just a chart to show, as this is very complicated, all the different moving pieces in a more visual format. So as you'll see in the fee-for-service environment for non-IMD programs, it's the 50% county, 50% federal. And then for managed care, it's the 50-50 state-county. That arrangement moves to where there was a federal share moving to the state in the IM area, and then without that authority, we see it shifting 100% to the counties. And that's my presentation, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to entertain any questions that members have.
All right, Mr. Burdick, thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burdick, you've covered a lot of complicated material really quickly. I'm just wondering, of the 8 IMDs that we have in Minnesota right now with 363 beds, I mean, that's an average of about 50. That's a pretty large facility. Is that both children's and adult IMDs, or is that just children's?
Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, this just represents the children's residential treatment facilities that are IMDs. So we do have, particularly in the substance use disorder realm, we've got a number of facilities that are IMDs. They do not face this same funding dynamic. They can access that state-only funding that I talked about previously.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair, and are we doing any work to downsize these so that they would qualify without having to go on to 100% state or 100% county funding?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Burdick.
So we actually have a report that we've been working on with Wilder Research about the whole continuum of children's intensive mental health services that we actually received the draft today, and so we hope to be sharing that with the legislature very soon that has some recommendations for longer-term planning. We also have a new level of care in Minnesota known as PRTF, or Psychiatric Residential Treatment Facilities, that are just coming online. Those are actually excluded in federal law from this IMD issue and so can capture federal dollars. But we do know that these facilities do serve an important part of the continuum, and so we're trying to make sure that this is really a means of ensuring the system is stable in the near term where we do that longer-term planning, but I think we're going to have a lot more conversation on what that longer-term planning looks like.
Well, thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Burdick. I really encourage you to try and not only to maximize the federal dollars, but I do think that children are better served closer to home, closer to family, not going to large services with large populations whenever we can. And I know there's a workforce shortage for psychiatrists and certain types of mental health professionals that you have to weigh as well. But I think the more that we can get to community-based care, the better we'd be.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question on the what is the magic of the 16 number as far as beds and why the difference there, please?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. That is an excellent question that I unfortunately do not have an answer for, and I think it's a question a lot of people have raised over the years. This has existed in federal law for decades, almost if not since the inception of the Medicaid program. The intent in part was to ensure that the federal government wasn't paying for large institutional settings, but the magic of the 16 I cannot answer, and I've not been able to find a good answer to in my years working on this.
So, Mr. Burdick, does this kind of go back to when we had state hospitals and then they were broken up and kind of the intent being we're going to fund stuff that doesn't take us in that back in that wrong direction? Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, that, I believe, is one element to this. I also understand there were some kind of fiscal constraints from the federal government's perspective. You know, mental health and substance use disorder has always been kind of treated as a secondary issue in the healthcare space, and so I think there's elements of that as well.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for members? All right, I'm not seeing any. Thank you, Mr. Burdick. I think that's really helpful to get a little overview on this, and, you know, I've been learning about this all session, and there's a lot here that I still didn't know, so thank you very much. So we're going to call up Representative Morrison to present her bill, and Representative Morrison is, let's see, is she on this meeting? No, she's not. Okay. So Representative Morrison, since you're not on the committee, I'm going to move your bill. So you can only move a bill if you're actually a member of the committee. So
thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to move that House File 679 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. So just to explain that for a moment to members, this was, well, I'll let you present the bill and then, you know, maybe it'll become clear. I don't want to, you know, jump into your presentation here, but maybe
it's
you'll
brief.
Explain
Thank
why
you,
we're
Madam
doing
Chair.
That. Please go ahead.
House File 679 addresses an urgent need to assure funding for children's residential mental health services for May and June of 2019. State funds were appropriated, as Mr. Burdick explained, in the 2017 budget, which passed in a special session to sustain children's residential mental health services in anticipation of an IMD designation by CMS. Unfortunately, for the math to work out for the special session agreement, 2 months of the for the biennium, May and June of 2019, were left unfunded in anticipation of that funding occurring in the 2018 session. Though there was bipartisan agreement to fund the last 2 months of 2018, funding was vetoed as part of the final spending bill last session, as referenced often. So now the issue is timing. Children and youth needing this level of care, their families, counties responsible to place them for treatment, and service providers all need reassurance that the state will keep its commitment and provide the needed state funding to assure services will be delivered this spring. Passing the needed $470,000 in funding early in the session sends a signal that serving kids in need of intensive mental health treatment is a priority. And I have Jamie Halpern here to testify on our behalf.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison. And I also, I just want to just note for members that there is a fiscal note in your packets. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Halpern, and please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Jamie Halpern. I'm an area manager in Hennepin County's Human Services Department. And I'm testifying today on behalf of MACSA, and we strongly support House File 679. This bill extends a critical short-term bridge in funding to sustain a fragile mental health system for Minnesota's children, youth, and their families. By assuring that stable funding remains in place throughout the current biennium, it provides the state with the opportunity to establish a longer-term plan to develop sustainable, community-driven system of care for children and youth with serious mental health needs, and it avoids the possibility of significant disruptions in the provision of critical treatment services. As many of you know, child protection reforms passed in 2015 have been costly. Minnesota's child protection caseloads and staffing levels increased by 60% over the last 4 years. And although the legislature provided significant funding to help enact these reforms, the total cost to counties of this growth has exceeded $72 million. The Minnesota Department of Human Services recently reported that the total cost of Minnesota's child welfare system was over $640 million in 2017, of which 45%, $287 million, was funded by counties, just short of twice the state's contribution. Without this legislation, the federal government's classification of Minnesota's residential treatment programs as IMDs will result in a new unfunded fiscal obligation for Minnesota's counties and local property taxpayers, as the loss of federal Medicaid reimbursement will need to be replaced with local funding. The loss of federal Medicaid reimbursement for Minnesota's residential programs will result in the transfer of several million dollars of additional annual costs to counties by the year 2020, and will very likely result in the elimination of essential mental health programs and services for our state's vulnerable children. This funding extension provided in HF 679 gives us the time to develop a longer-term solution without disrupting current services. On behalf of Minnesota counties, I urge your support for this proposal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Halpern. Are there any questions for members? All right. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Should this funding, this emergency funding, not happen and you spoke of diminished services, what specifically might happen or could very well happen?
Mr. Halpern.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a interesting and difficult question. I think it would be determined by each county. There are a number of possibilities, from children languishing in hospital care or in shelter care programs because we're looking for residential treatment programs that might be less costly, from residential treatment programs seeing reductions in their enrollment and having diminished capacity to serve kids, or it could be counties have to take this money out of other parts of their mental health system in order to pay for residential treatment. Residential treatment is a huge cost driver in our county social service budgets, and without this state replacement of the federal money in the short term, those costs would draw from the rest of our mental health budgets.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions for members? All right. Not seeing any. So with that, Representative Morrison renews her motion that House File. I renew my motion that House File 679 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
The next bill on our calendar for today is House File 876, Representative Cantrell. And before we get to him, we are going to have another brief presentation on federally qualified health centers. And this might be Mr. Wilson. Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will Wilson from the Department of Health, Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. Our office administers the grant program that you're going to be discussing in the bill that's coming up after me. I'm here to give just a brief overview of the program itself, and I think maybe at the same time a little bit of background information about what FQHCs do from our perspective. You have a handout in your packets from the Department of Health that says Federally Qualified Health Center Subsidy Grant Program, and that's what I'm going to be referring to quite a bit in my comments. As you can see there, the subsidy itself had the funding for this program has fluctuated a little bit over the years. There have been some times when the legislature has passed either 2 years of funding or maybe 1 year of funding that has blinked on and off. The basic appropriation is there, the first line, and then there's a little bit of money that also comes from the Healthcare Access Fund that supports this program. The distribution of the funding itself is fairly straightforward. As you can see, this is the list of all the federally qualified health centers in Minnesota. I will mention the last three. There's a little bit of a wrinkle there, the one in Worthington and Moorhead. Those are organizations that are based outside of the state, but they have clinics here in Minnesota, and so they're serving Minnesota patients. And the last one, Access Medical Center, is a what's known as an FQHC lookalike. They're kind of on their way to becoming a fully-fledged federally qualified health center.
And could I just pause you there, Mr. Wilson, and maybe ask you to back up a little bit, because sure. We have new members on the committee, and I'm not sure everybody even understands what a federally qualified health center is. And so could you just give us just a little bit of background on that? You know, why would we be funding these things separately from anything else we fund?
Happy to do that. So a federally qualified health center is pretty much what it sounds like. There is a federal program known as the 330 program. I'm sorry to throw out a bunch of jargon here, but what it entitles these clinics to is essentially cost-based reimbursement. They are reimbursed differently. They receive a flat rate that is intended to cover the majority of the costs that they incur while they're serving the patients. And in exchange for that, they provide certain minimum services to these patients as well. They have to have a sliding fee scale, and they have to serve anybody who walks into their door. That's really the basis of the program. And so this program on the state level supplements some of the costs that they incur while delivering care that they are not reimbursed for. And if you look at the column there to the right that says sliding fee discount, this is how this grant program is calculated. Each clinic reports to us, to the Department of Health, in the most recent year available, in this case it was 2017, the amount of money that they have given to their patients in discounts from their sliding fee. And this is for low-income Minnesotans. And as you can see, the total there is about $26 million. That number fluctuates a little bit from year on year, but it has remained above $20 million since 2010. And then the grant program itself is a calculation that distributes the funds based on a fairly simple formula. No clinic will receive less than 2% of the available funding, and no clinic will receive more than 30% of the available funding. And so if you look at the ones that are the 62,000, that's the 2% number. And then Westside receives the 30% number as a maximum. This funding, if you just do a quick calculation, it's about 13% of the reported discounts that are given to patients on the sliding fee scale by these clinics. And that's relatively consistent. It's between, you know, there have been fluctuations both in funding and in the amount that's reported in sliding fee discounts. It's between 10 and 15% generally. I don't think we've gone above 15%. So essentially the grant program is subsidizing about 15% of the discounts that are provided to these patients. Now, I think the other question is, how are they spending the money? And that's on the other side of the sheet. We run the program as a grant, which means that clinics submit an application, they give us a project description and a budget for how they're going to spend the money. And in general, I think the way that clinics are spending the money adjusts over the years to the projects that they see are the most valuable. Some of them use the funds very directly for expanding access to patients or maintaining services. Some of them use it a little bit more creatively. And I'll go through a couple of these. You've got the list in front of you of some examples of how these clinics are spending the money, but I'll highlight a couple of them. Scenic Rivers Health Services is out of Big Fork, Minnesota, and they're using these funds to purchase dental equipment, including updating their x-ray machines so that they can provide better care for their patients, both in their Big Fork and their Floodwood clinic. I would highlight the Native American Community Clinic as well, which is using the funds to increase cancer screening and also to expand medication-assisted therapy for their opioid-dependent patients. This is an activity that's something that FQHCs are struggling to pay for the full scope of services that are available under medication-assisted therapy. We think that's a creative use of these funds. And then finally, Sawtooth Mountain Clinic has found a very creative way to expand dental access. For the dental patients that they can't serve, they are referring them to other dental providers in Grand Marais, and then they are helping to subsidize that care, essentially extending their own sliding fee scale to these other partner clinics within the area. Mm-hmm. We think that's a creative use of these funds as well. For the most part, recently, I would say that a lot of the projects have been dental in nature, and also data-oriented in nature, so that these clinics can capture the data that they're about what they're delivering to their patients more accurately, and they're measuring quality outcomes as well. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions, members? Okay, I'm not seeing any. I have one myself. So you're talking about we're subsidizing the discount that they're giving their patients off of the sliding fee. Mm-hmm. So is there a set discount from the sliding fee, or is that something that clinics decide themselves? Or when you have a sliding fee, usually you think that's based on income, so people can pay whatever that is. So it's a little unusual maybe to say, well, we have that, and then we have a discount off of that. Could you just explain that a bit more?
Sure. There's a requirement for federally qualified health centers to have a sliding fee schedule in place, and it has to go up to a certain income threshold. I believe it's 175% of federal poverty guidelines. So they are required to provide these discounts, and I believe it's up to the clinic to decide exactly what that discount would be for each individual as they're coming through the program. They have the ability to work with patients individually, but they have to have the overall structure of a sliding fee scale in place for these discounts.
Okay. Questions for members? Okay. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question was similar to yours, but the subsidy amount that's paid to these clinics has nothing to do with the fee structure that they have or their discounts, right? Because you could have one clinic say this service is $1,000, and another clinic say it's $100, and one's going to have a bigger loss showing up in their sliding fee discount. But the subsidy amount that's paid, is it a fixed amount per service, or do you pay some clinics more for certain services and others not?
Mr. Wilson.
That's a good question. The answer is a little complicated. When federally qualified health centers, another requirement that they have is that they have to report all of their costs to the federal government, and that includes everything that they're doing, the care that they're delivering, their administrative services, everything. And then this is included in that report to the federal government as a defined data element of the amount of discounts that they're giving. So this complies, essentially this number has already been determined by the clinic because they have to report it to the federal government as a discount. I'm not exactly aware of how they calculate it, but it's the same calculation for each clinic. I don't think there's a lot of leeway in how they interpret that. This is just a data point that they have to submit on a cost report to the federal government. So I think the data is relatively consistent from clinic to clinic.
And then, Representative Munson.
And then if a patient is applying for a sliding fee discount, what type of documentation is required for them to get that discount? Is it stated income, or do they have to show any kind of proof of anything?
Mr. Wilson.
That one I'm going to have to defer to the association that's going to come up after me. I'm not at that level of detail. I apologize.
Okay. Thank you, Madam
Chair. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Munson. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. I guess are we – okay, so the association's going to come up, I think, to testify on the bill. So I think we will, and so we're going to call on Representative Cantrell to come up and present your bill. And so Representative Cantrell has House File 876, and Representative Cantrell is going to move that the bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the division bill.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So welcome to the committee, and Representative Cantrell, go ahead and present your bill and turn it over to your testifiers when you're ready to do that.
Well, phenomenal. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to testify before the Health and Human Services Finance Committee today. Kind of a brief overview. I don't want to be redundant with the previous testifier's presentation. What House File 876 does is appropriate $5 million for each of the next two fiscal years to the Commissioner of Health to be distributed as subsidies to federally qualified health centers, also known as community health centers. Which has significantly fewer syllables. And so just kind of a brief overview of why both personally and I think all of us as lawmakers need to be invested in the overall mission of securing the financial solvency of federally qualified health centers. In 2018, these centers served 190,000 Minnesotans. About 90% of those patients were below 200% of the federal poverty level. So that's about 171,000 people. And what these centers do is provide access to integrated primary medical services, behavioral services, and dental services as well, oftentimes for folks who don't have resources otherwise to access these critical services. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the testifiers here, and if that's right with you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. So welcome to the committee, and whoever's going to go first, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Danny Ackert. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. I just wanted to pause and say, Madam Chair, would you like me to answer Representative Munson's question now, or would hold till pause questions after all the testifiers go?
Well, I would just say, why don't you just go ahead and do your presentation, and we'll hold that question to the end and let you present the way you had intended to do it.
Perfect. Thank you. With me today is Shauna Hedlund from West High Community Health Services, or now known as Minnesota Community Care, Doug Yeager, who's the CEO at Open Door out of Mankato, and Stella Whitney West, who's the CEO of North Point Health and Wellness in Minneapolis. And I will be around to stand for questions that might arise.
All right, thank you. Hey, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Shauna Hedlund. I'm with Minnesota Community Care, formerly known as Westside Community Health Services, and I'm the Director of School Age Wellness, which incorporates the school-based clinics in 10 of St. Paul's senior high schools. We have 17 locations with Minnesota Community Care, 2 ambulatory care clinics, 5 shelters, or 5 clinics inside of shelters and housing communities, and 10 inside of high schools. We provide 22,000 visits, about 22,000 visits every year with our integrated care providers. That number does not include the number of outreach events in classrooms, community events, enabling services provided by community health workers, health educators, registered dietitians, and care coordinators that are also on our staff. In the school-based clinics, which I know best, we serve over 5,000 kids each year, which is about 25% of the students at each of the schools that we serve. And we touch about 9,000 lives in addition to that in our outreach events and various support groups. For an example of the kind of care we provide, it's primary care. We also provide behavioral health care. We also have nutritional services and health educators on staff. The health educators are there. We claim to provide, as FQHCs, better access to care, and that has traditionally been translation, transportation. We get you to the door of a health care center. We provide a sliding fee, so we make it financially accessible for you. But we also provide wraparound services that ensure that care is not only accessible to you when you walk through our door, but when you return to your home and walk through your own door, it continues to be accessible to you. We provide the kind of wraparound services that help you integrate your health care into your life to make sure the outcomes come to fruition that we hope for. Let's see. About 35% of the kids that we see in the school-based clinics are uninsured. We have asked those students, where would you go if you didn't come to our school-based clinics? And the two most likely answers we find are to the ER or to nowhere. We are in the schools as an access model. We provide integrated care to help make that health information and healthcare accessible in their lives. In addition, we are there to change education outcomes. I am formerly a teacher, and I will say I have seen no finer example of how we affect the education outcomes for students than addressing the underlying health disparities that they are entrenched in their lives. That's what we do best. Just wanted to give you two quick examples before I close of new programs that we would integrate into our offerings with this subsidy. One is that we've just started working more closely with corrections in Ramsey County, with students that are coming back to school after out-of-home placement, integrating them immediately into mental health support with the hope of keeping them in school. And we hope to expand that program. We're also seeing increasing mental health needs among our students. In the last 2 years, we increased our services by 13%, and then this year already in this school year, demand for care has increased by 19% in 10 schools. We see kids that are deeply affected by rising levels of addiction to opioids in their homes and in their families. We are seeing decreasing addiction among students, but they are deeply affected and experience the collateral damage of that being a part of how they are living outside of school. The best way I can summarize what we do is we provide holistic care to kids. We provide that care to whole families, whole schools, and to the whole community.
All right. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Doug Yeager. I'm the CEO at Open Door Health Center in Mankato, Minnesota. We end up serving basically the entire southern part of Minnesota. We have served clients in 55 different counties. We currently have three facilities, with our main facility in Mankato, Minnesota. And last year we served just shy of 11,500 patients. We do medical, dental, and behavioral health, and we also have mobile programs that go out throughout the southern region to serve these patients. The subsidy that we receive has helped in our medical facilities specifically. 50% of our patients are uninsured, and so these subsidies has helped offset those costs. Our mobile programs that go into the schools and serve the other smaller communities have been very helpful. What we're experiencing in southern Minnesota are closings of clinics in the rural communities, and so with the additional funds, we would be looking at helping to put that health care back into those local communities to keep health care local, so those people don't have to drive the hours and hours that they have been coming to our clinics throughout southern Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Welcome, committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Stella Whitney West, and I'm the CEO of North Point Health and Wellness Center. We are located in North Minneapolis, and we are a public entity, FQHC, and what that means is that we are in partnership with Hennepin County. North Point has served over 28,000 patients annually and over 108,000 visits annually. We have a main campus, and then we also have two satellite sites, and we also are operating in seven public schools. Three of the schools are high schools, three are middle school, and one is an elementary school. North Point has been the recipient of this FQHC subsidy grant for about 7 years. And these are the types of operations and activities that this grant has allowed us to do. We have a Northside teen clinic, and we're the only teen clinic in Minneapolis. So we have started expanding those hours in that teen clinic, and the clinic serves teens up to young adults age 21. So we have been able to expand those hours and up to 4 days a week. We also have a program that we call our OB Care Coordination Program, and this is a program where we're able to provide services to high-risk pregnant women and their partners, and we provide wraparound services to make sure that there is a healthy birth, healthy outcome for the mother and the child, low birth weight, and high infant mortality. in North Minneapolis and among African American women is the ongoing disparity. Also, we provide financial case aid counseling. So we have about 36% of our patients are uninsured. We have found that for many of these patients, that if they have access to a counselor that can help them go through all of the paperwork and help them determine if they are eligible for any public health program, that we are able to at least get as many of those as we can insured. And so we provide financial case aids for those patients that are uninsured. We also, through our school-based clinics, have been able to provide behavior health services. We have found that many of the children in the schools are suffering with trauma-related behaviors, usually related to exposure to violence or instability within their family. We found that if we are able to provide those services in school, that keeps the child in school, that also our clinicians are able to provide support for the school staff as well by providing training for them on how to work with children who have been exposed to trauma. So we thank you for this subsidy and certainly for our testimonies.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any other testifiers? Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify for or against the bill? All right. Seeing none. So Representative Munson is on the list. Representative Munson, I don't know if you want to just repeat the previous question or add.
Yeah. So the previous question was just about how we determine what the subsidies are for each of the services. And I actually did look up the statute, and it is directly tied to the numbers didn't jive on the spreadsheet that I was handed, but that's because we're looking at the sliding fee discounts from 2017 and then the subsidies given in 2019. And so I'm just trying to figure out and drill in, is the because the subsidies are granted exactly proportional to the discounts that were reported by the companies, but it looks like there isn't any pricing that's considered on what the fees for service are actually charged. So can you speak to that and then also how people apply for subsidies and what they need to bring for documentation?
Yeah, Mr. Eckert, could you spell your name for me, please?
A-C-K-E-R-T.
A-C-K-E-R-T. Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Munson, patients, when they are coming to a community health center, a federally qualified health center, to receive a sliding fee scale discount, they must produce a pay stub. And so that then triggers the sliding fee schedule at each clinic that is, as Mr. Wilson testified or presented earlier, very similar to each clinic. And then based on the pay stub, that identifies what type of sliding fee discount that patient is able to receive.
Representative Munson.
And so everybody has their own fee scale, but there's nothing that's required by this program that would say that for an X-ray, this is what you have to charge. You could charge $26,000 for an X-ray and then give somebody a major discount on that, and that would show up in your sliding fee discount.
Mr. Eckert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can follow up with you on the details on this, but I can tell you that no federally qualified health center would remain a federally qualified health center if they abused the sliding fee discount. The feds, HRSA and CMS, have a jeweler's eye when they look at this, and the amount of regulation that they must pass in order to remain a federally qualified health center would prevent, they would be out of the program as soon as they were trying to abuse this or use it in such a way as I think you're inferring.
Okay.
And then, Representative Munson, one more.
Yeah, follow up. One of my concerns is about when we supply money from the state of Minnesota, that money stay in Minnesota, and preferably with nonprofit organizations.
Yes.
But when I was just looking at my phone here, looking up a couple of companies, the Access Family Medical Clinic in Representative Hamplin's district, is actually a South Dakota nonprofit. They do business in six states. And is there anything that keeps the money that we're giving to a multi-state nonprofit doing business in Minnesota that keeps that money in Minnesota for Minnesota services versus just throwing it into the nonprofit that serves multiple states?
Mr. Ackert.
I will have to refer to Mr. Wilson on this for the specific technical assistance, but the subsidies are only allowed for services and clinics rendered to Minnesotans in Minnesota. So the subsidies only qualify for those who are treated in Minnesota, who receive signing fee discounts at clinics in Minnesota. So as far as maintaining that those funds, or the subsidy funds that go to the clinics that have outside, that are from the Dakotas who have clinic sites here, like in Worthington, I cannot directly say that they do not take those funds and put those funds into accessing or expanding access to their clinics in the Dakotas, mm-hmm. but I can definitely say that they're not able to draw down signing fee scales or anything, subsidies from services they provide outside of Minnesota.
Okay, and just one small follow-up, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative.
The statute actually lists that the money has to go to federally qualified health centers operating in Minnesota as of January 1st, 2007. Are there any federally qualified health centers that are operating either outside of Minnesota or maybe that have started since that date that are receiving funds? Are you keeping to this statute, or does that need to be changed?
Mr. Acker?
We are keeping to that statute.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I have a couple of other members on the list, but I just want to clarify something, Mr. Acker. I think I misunderstood before. When you're talking about a subsidy, you're talking about the sliding fee discount and then the mm-hmm. subsidy. So I was thinking that you were giving somebody a sliding fee, billing them only a sliding fee, and then giving them a discount off of that. But that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about the money the clinic is foregoing by using a sliding fee, right?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, thank you. I just completely misunderstood what this was, so I'm glad to get that cleared up. Representative Haley, and then Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be a question for Mr. Wilson.
Okay.
Mr. I'm curious. There aren't any FQHCs in southeastern Minnesota on this list, just geography-wise. Does there have to be a certain density of population of need in order for a facility to qualify? Can you comment on that? And then maybe additionally, one of the previous presenters made the comment of, we are seeing clinics and hospitals close in rural Minnesota, particularly, southern Minnesota. And if you comment on that trend, would you see then opportunity that we would have more federally qualified health centers to bridge that gap?
Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, yes, there is a requirement that in order to be a federally qualified health center, you have to be in a health professional shortage area. Because of the makeup of the marketplace in southeastern Minnesota, it is difficult we are also the place that designates these areas. Our office does this work as well, whether or not an area is in a shortage area or not. We have looked at southeastern Minnesota almost every way possible to see if we
can. So have I.
to see if we can achieve a health professional shortage area, or there's also a medically underserved area or a medically mm-hmm. underserved population. There are a lot of different ways that we can do this. We have as yet not been able to find a way to do that because of the makeup of the marketplace in southeast Minnesota. The Mayo Clinic, in a sense, skews the data for the entire region, and so it's difficult to do that. On your question about clinics closing, yes, we are tracking that. We are aware that there are some access points that are closing down. I will say that there is an opportunity for federally qualified health centers. There's occasionally a pot of money that becomes available for new access points, and that is open right now. And so we're expecting to see quite a few applications from clinics that would like to become a federally qualified health center And I think our office would be helpful in providing whatever data we can and information that we can to those clinics as they do that. We're happy to provide technical assistance.
Can I have a brief follow-up?
Representative Haley.
Can a community clinic qualify to be a FQHC? I always have to look at this. FQHC.
I believe so, as long as they can meet the requirements of what is laid out, the requirements to be designated as a federally qualified health center. Mm-hmm. And that includes things like they have to have a community-run board, they have to provide a minimum set of services, et cetera. But if they meet those requirements, then yes, they can.
So that could be an opportunity and under
Representative
these.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That could be an opportunity under this new access points that you're talking about.
Correct. That's right, Madam Chair. And, Madam Chair, if I might answer the previous question as well, regarding the clinics that are outside, are they headquartered outside of Minnesota, the statute is silent on this. However, we give guidance to these clinics that when they do receive these funds, that the funds should be spent in Minnesota, and we believe that they are doing that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Wilson, maybe. So can you talk a little bit about how strict the regulations, or even maybe Stella Whitney West can also talk about this, but just how strict are the regulations in forming a community health center? Or are there, like, opportunities for to wiggle or be flexible?
I'll be brief and then I'll pass it off to the expert. I think there are quite a few requirements. There's the geographic requirement, there's the health professional shortage area, there's the some clinics need to reorganize themselves so that they do have a community-run board, and that can be a lot of work. It's not easy to become a federally qualified health center, but I think as speaking to what those requirements are like for each clinic, I'll defer to the clinic itself.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Whitney West.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, thank you for that question. It is not easy to qualify to be a federally qualified health center. There are over 19, 20 different program requirements that you have to meet, including having a community board that at least 51% of those community board members have to be patients of your health center. The federal government comes out every 3 years, and they do a on-site audit to make sure that we are meeting all of those 19 program requirements, including the sliding fee scale. They also even look at our community board members. They have authority to look at their medical records to make sure that they have had a qualified health visit within the last 2 years. So you just can't have somebody on your board and say that they're a patient without HRSA coming in, the federal government, and documenting that they indeed are a patient. There is a minimum required set of services that you also have to provide as well.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So thank you for that information, because just to be very transparent, I am a huge supporter of community health service. I grew up in a community, in a neighborhood, where it was the local clinic that served the people. And one of the benefits of having local community health centers is that you see people from your community who are working in the clinic, who are serving in the community. And it's a really holistic, it's not just a medical clinic, it is mental health, it is dental care, it is WIC, it's a very comprehensive type of community health clinic that really values the people in that community and have connections and relations to that community. And so, looking at the southeast part of it, it's those families, those folks who have to drive so far to get health care. And not everyone can, afford a Mayo or a health partner or a Aetna. We are just so thankful here that we do have health coverage. But it's those low-income individuals who don't have health care coverage and often are using the emergency room as health care, that they are able to go right into those local communities and get some service provided for them and their children and their families. So I just wanted to state that it plays a huge role in reducing the health disparities that we see within the state of Minnesota, but also, more importantly, it works to really create some great outcomes for children and women and families. So thank you for this bill, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Moran. Are there other questions, members? Okay, not seeing any. And I have to say I also am very impressed with some of what we heard about some of the outreach and the creative uses of the funding. Is really great. So seeing no further questions, with that, the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the division bill. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Cantrell.
Thank you.
So, members, we are in a rare situation for this committee. I think this might be the first time we've actually gotten done really early and had hopefully had all your questions answered. So tomorrow, just for your planning, we will be beginning to hear the governor's budget. We'll be hearing the budget for the next couple of days. So thank you very much. With that, we are adjourned.